Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the show. It's the 41st show of the Retro Computing Roundtable. That's the RCR. It's our last one for 2012. We made it through the apocalypse, and we're back. This, you can't stop us. And we're recording live on Sunday, December 23rd. The RCR is hosted by CyberEars. Have them host your podcasts and audio files, too. Go to cyberears.com for more details. It's me, Earl, today. The whole RCR family is back together again. Yes, this is our first show, all three of us, in how long? Quite a while.
Two months, something like that, month and a half.
Carrington ran off and did his work thing last time.
It's our special homecoming show.
Oh. Yeah, it's a very special episode of the RCR.
Just like the Waltons.
So in alphabetical order, first, hello, Carrington.
Hello, guys. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you today?
I'm excellent. It's chilly here in Canada, but that's appropriate for the season. So I'll put up with it for like 1 week, and then I'll start to complain.
Yeah, that's what I do, too. It gets rainy here, and I'm like, oh, man, but I live in Portland, so, you know, what do I want? So next up is David. How are you doing there, David? How is life
in the greater
Atlanta area?
It is, you know, I'm a little disappointed that it's so warm, believe it or not, because, you know, I actually enjoy some cold weather, because you're just 2 days out before Christmas, and so it is, Carrington, 13 degrees here right now, 56.
And so, I'm out of here. That's why I wasn't on the show, man. You're rubbing it in.
Actually, it doesn't feel that chilly out here to me. I mean, chilly, right, for us, but, yeah, so it's pretty mild, you know, considering. And it looks like for the rest of the week, it's only going to get as low as, well, it's going to get like 29 in the evenings, which I don't, you know, zero, I guess. That's below freezing.
They don't use your made-up temperatures.
But anyway, yeah, crazy Fahrenheit stuff.
It's good to be back and all of us back together again. You see, the second time in a row I've done it outside. It's nice out here. But I'm kind of trying to redo my office. It's a mess.
I love the Christmassy look of your outside scene there, David.
The bare trees.
Yeah, kind of stark winter sort of. It's very appropriate.
And, of course, sorry, audio audience, but you see, obviously, those are pine trees. That's why they're not bare.
Mm. Yes. Yes, we've got the evergreens here, too, and they're very nice. Hey, guys, so, you know, it's right before the holidays, and I have a confession to make. I'm not done with my shopping. So I'm going to keep a very tight ship today on the RCR and, like, you know, ram this thing down our throats. But, you know, we've got to give a couple extra minutes to Carrington because apparently he's got an amazing new surprise gadget.
I do. I lucked into something huge, physically huge, and something I didn't think I would ever get to have. So, as you know, I do another podcast, No Quarter, with Mike McGinnis. Well, actually, he does it. And I've been talking lately about the idea that I was thinking of maybe picking up a coin-op cabinet. So I actually got one of those, but that's not what I'm showing today. So I purchased my first coin-op cabinet this past week, but it hasn't arrived yet because I'm having some stuff done to it in the States and it'll be coming up. So I'll have that in a couple of weeks. It'll be here.
Probably has to be ship freight, right?
Yeah, sure. But luckily, I have another podcast that's sponsored by a shipping company.
Very helpful.
It all sort of came together nicely. So I've got that one coming up in a few weeks. And so that got me just looking around at that sort of thing.
Are you able to say what that one is? Tell us what that one
is. No, I'm going to leave it as a surprise. So, I'll leave you guessing. So, but it's I'm really, really excited about it. So, so separately from that, it got me looking at coin-op cabinets, that kind of stuff, and just did sort of a general search 2 days ago. And coincidentally, like out of nowhere, for some reason, I found that this was listed. It is a Wreck-It Ralph. Fix-It Felix Jr. cabinet that Disney handmade. Only 12 of them were made in the world.
Are you kidding?
This is the actual ones. So Disney kept 9 of them and then gave 3 away. It's the same as the cabinet that just sold for $20,000 on eBay. So it's actually the functional, real Fix-It Felix Jr. cabinet.
Oh, my God.
How did you get your hands on this?
It is a crazy coincidence. So the short version is basically a person won it in a contest and said, like, why would I possibly want one of these, and just post it on the net. And I happened to look, like, 20 seconds after they posted it and just said, I'll pay you this much. I'll do it right now, and I'll do it by wire transfer. Like, and so just picked it up for a song, like, for nothing, and then had to go out and get it. So yesterday I had to go and fetch this thing. So it's crazy. There's only, like, 3 of them out in the wild, 12 of them made in total. So the Disney places have the rest of them. You can go down to Disney and actually play them. They made another few of them that were not actually functional cabinets. They're just they were just the outside of cabinets that toured in front of movie theaters. But this is the one where you can actually, like, I don't know if you can see it, but it's actually playing in the demo mode at the moment.
Yeah.
And it's the actual, I have the high score at the moment. So it's actually one of the 12 existing Wreck-It Ralph machines. Like, it's made out of an old Donkey Kong. They put the word out for Donkey Kong cabinet, so that's what they constructed it out of. And then they just made actual game. So this is the actual one that the press got to work with and that kind of stuff. It's all scratched up on the side, which I even said to them, oh, it's too bad it's all scratched up. But it came from Disney with photos of it. This is actually, they had the Disney designers scratched everything up on purpose because it's supposed to look like it comes from
1980. An old machine, so, yeah. Yeah, because in the movie it's an old machine.
Yeah, so this is, it comes with the stuff directly from Disney with the information about this particular cabinet and 2 different telephone numbers and my personal Disney tech troubleshooters that I can call, John or Joe, that I can reach at Disney if I've got issues with the machine stuff. Crazy!
Holy cow.
So it's unbelievably rare. It's the kind of thing I never would have possibly thought, oh, I think maybe I'll want a cabinet. I got that. Oh. Okay, I'll take that one.
Like, man, that is quite a get.
So it's so it's technically my second coin-op machine because I bought another one like 2 days before that, not thinking I was going to suddenly start a collect. I'm not even a collector, so now I own 2 of them.
Ah, yeah.
And so now I have this one here. So it's awesome.
I sort of predict you are a collector now.
Oh, well, I guess, yeah. So I'm going to shortly have 2 of them behind me in a couple of weeks. So this is my first one ever. I'm loving the heck out of having it. It's actually a fun game to play. It's totally different experience playing on this cabinet than it was when I checked the game out. Like, Disney released it as an online game.
Yeah. But you know what, Carrington? That totally guy different. The guy that sold you that, I totally predict he's going to totally regret it one day.
I would think so. That and it's one of those things where, I mean, it's not like it cost me, you know, thousands of dollars, but it was, like, you know, a chunk of change. But I thought, you know what, I'm getting it. I'm sure I could. If I change my mind, I'll be able to sell it later. And so I'm delighted having it. It's like such a cool item to have. So,
and you know, Wreck-It Ralph was a great movie, and of course,
I loved it.
It's not a Pixar film; it's a Walt Disney animation film. And I think it's sort of like it's the first big CGI film that they've done, where now it's like, you know, they've reached the level of a Pixar film.
I think so too. So here I'll move
this
over.
This is a big movie. It's going to be.
Yeah, I loved Wreck-It Ralph, so I'm happy with the game. I'm happy with the cabinet. I loved Wreck-It Ralph itself.
Yeah, but culturally, it's going to gain value and be very, you know, sought after for a long time.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where I didn't want it as a, oh my gosh, yeah, I can turn around and sell it on eBay.
An investment,
I wanted it
sure.
What a cool, no, also just what a cool thing to have. So yeah,
right,
so
it's
the first cabinet I've ever owned in my house, although it's technically the second one I purchased. And I'm going to do a video about it itself
and
show people the insides of it and the measurements. When I went and picked it up, I actually took it over to one of the Navis locations and stuck it on a scale. So, because there's not a lot of info about these actual cabinets. So I'll do a lot of documentation about it and stuff and scan the Disney stuff that came with it and things. And it's cool because it even lists, there's like a mistake in one of the 2 they sent me where it talks about how, please include a marketing message for the movie. I think they were supposed to actually put a marketing message in. But.
My son, yeah. I'll show him this right after the show or as soon as I can, and believe me, this segment of our show, he's gonna go crazy seeing.
Yeah,
this.
I'm so
he's
happy.
Love it.
Just yeah, so it's kind of hard to see the marquee on top because the camera's not picking it up, but yeah. Just says Fix-It Felix Jr. and yeah, so that's
I know you want to call it Wreck-It Ralph, but it's Fix-It Felix Jr.
Yes. Yeah. So that is my surprise. My first coin-op cabinet and
so
crazy
fun.
To have one that's like one of, I think, just 12 actual units.
Just awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
So that's the first segment. I'm so thrilled.
Well, everything after that is going to be a tough act to follow, but, you know, the show must go on. Wow, that's just great, Carrington. David, there's something exciting about the upcoming Kansas Fest, right, that you have to tell us?
Yeah, so Kansas Fest came out with a press release. So they're just announcing their keynote speaker, which is pretty exciting. It's Randy Wigington, and he's a very early Apple employee. He was employee number 6. And see, he was, you know, part of the, I guess, the early team that I had this up, and then, but he was part of like the Disk 2, you know, working with Wozniak, mm-hmm. and I know, and the Apple One, and just all that kind of stuff. And he was really young when he was doing this stuff. He was like 14 years old, and he was also, he used to go to the Homebrew Computer Club. But there's a link to Kansas Fest, their webpage, and it's actually, they've posted an update since, so it's the second one down. And it talks more about it. So that's going to be really great to see.
That's
him.
A great choice. Like, I'm really excited about it.
So he's roughly, I don't know, 14 and 77 or something.
I think he's 16 now. He doesn't age at the same rate as us.
He's like 40 something. I don't know.
And being employee number 6 really just means he's like right at the very beginning. Because I remember reading, I think Bill Atkinson or somebody had posted something online about how when they gave out the employee numbers was like a particular day, and he was late that afternoon, so he got to be number 12. Because it really just means you're there at the very beginning if you're one of those numbers.
Oh, your audio went crazy there for me for a minute.
Yeah, you went all silent on us for a second there, Carrington. But we basically got what you were saying. So Kansas Fest just has this continuing precedent of having great keynote speakers. It's very impressive.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think it's the big thing is, it's the 35th anniversary of the Disk 2 disk drive in 2013. So that's ties it in, you know, a little bit with Randy Wigington.
25th. Isn't this the 25th Kansas Fest as well?
Something like that. I think they've talked about this, not in this particular press release, but
nice you talk about floppy disks, though, because that's a good segue into my news item.
But remember Kansas Fest, July.
That's right. Well, if you need floppy disks or other media, I went looking for somewhere that I could find them. And there was a posting on, I think it was the CC Tech mailing list recently, about where you could find media. And one of the places is Athena.com. So I actually gave these folks a call and said, there's an emerging need for 5 1/4 media out there, new 5 1/4 media. It's getting a little progressively harder to find. I mean, you can find folks selling them on eBay and that kind of thing, but you don't know the provenance of that media. You basically don't know where it's been. And with these folks, they've got media 5 1/4 double density, for instance. The manufacture date, I think they told me was back in 93, but they made the media. It's been in their possession ever since. I said, do you have a bunch? And they said, yeah, we've got a truckload of it. So I just thought that I would put this website up here. It's part of my continuing quest to figure out what we're going to do as the retro community about the fact that our media is dying. Jason Scott has posted about this. Other people have posted about it. We've talked about it here. What are we going to do? I mean, we can keep the floppy drives alive, but we can't keep the media going. So here's one place you can go get some media.
I think the solution is going to be Melissa Barron is going to simply store all data through her loom. We'll send it to her, and she will make us tapestries that have all the data in it, and we'll just have to do that way. I think it's going seriously old school.
Honestly, do you guys think that there's any way to refurbish floppy disks?
I have not a lot, but I have a good little bit of like extra 5 1/4s and the extra 3 1/2s, and you know, brand new ones. And but lately, when I've messed with them, I've noticed some of them have been bad.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they're new old stock, and I try to take good care of storing them, and I try, you know, so I don't know, how would you refurb them other than try to reinitialize them and they just don't work?
I don't know. Magnetism doesn't like heat, so yeah. I guess heating them up to try to restore the coating or whatever isn't a good idea. But but maybe could you take them out and spray something on them?
Or you could scrub them. I know people do clean them. You can scrub them down with like basic soap and stuff like that and put it back in. But maybe there's a way to get it back to that, you know, maybe do heat it and liquefy it and then reset the magnet stuff. I don't know.
I mean, this is crazy, but is there a way that somebody could manufacture them? I mean, things are getting more and more possible to make within your own makerspace or something like that.
3D printers.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I just saw an article on Wired where somebody 3D printed a phonograph record. And
yeah, I saw that too. Oh, yeah. You tweeted that, I guess.
Yeah,
the only good 3D printer is a 3D printer that can make 3D printers. Just got to make that one purchase.
The robots are going to make the robots, and from there on, we're obsolete. But so anyway, floppy disks.
And of course,
we can figure out how to make them. I mean, there's floppy disk replacements. That's not as much fun. I want to have an actual floppy disk drive, just like back in the day. And we got to figure out a way to make new media. But anyway,
but the good news is, of course, more and more people are taking it off the old media onto digital. Well, I guess it's digital. You know what I mean? Off the new media,
which is it's a great important thing to do too. Make sure
at some point, I guess it's just going to run out. I mean, just like at some point, most people aren't going to be able to use a retro computer. It's going to all be through emulation and that sort of thing. But hopefully we'll have a lot of that real old software.
I'll be dead by then. But it's funny, in the movie Armageddon, when the guys who are going to the asteroid are negotiating what they want the government to give them, one of them says, "I want you to bring 8-track tapes back." Bruce Willis kind of shakes his head and says, I probably can't do that, right? But, I don't want floppy media to go away. Anyway, we got to move on. Carrington, tell us why, if I have a ZX Spectrum, I can hear it on my AM radio.
You can't, because it's the ZX Spectrum, you American. And that's the whole story. We're done. It's ZZ Top, that wonderful band. So the ZX Spectrum, it's an interesting article we're linking to over at theregister.co.uk. And they put the ZX Spectrum through a radio frequency test, a modern one. In England, it's the EN55022 test. There's equivalent FCC requirements in the States, the Schedule 15B requirement. You'll see stamped or stickered onto anything you buy now that's electronic in America. It's just, your electronic devices have to be proven and tested to not cause radio interference of other things. So somebody actually went back and said, well, what if we grab a ZX Spectrum and put it through a modern test? And it as it says in the article, it doesn't just fail, it fails abjectly. Like, it absolutely doesn't even come close to passing. And they suspect that that's probably the case with most old tech. It is the case that now one of the downsides of older tech is it causes crazy radio frequency interference compared to modern tests.
Well, I mean, we know that one of the popular things to do with the Altair, or I think you could do it with a PDP-8 also, was exploit that capability of it generating radio interference to actually make it play a song.
I'm hoping that it'll give me superpowers.
Well, I think it already has, right? I mean, you're already Canadian and you want superpowers.
Canadian
also?
Is a superpower.
Jiminy Cricket.
Have you guys... sorry. Just to mention, because a comment by Barry DeJager here in the comment section. Barry DeJager?
Jaeger.
Anyway, he says the HXC200... 2001 is the best solution for a floppy drive replacement. I never use old media anymore. Do you guys heard of that one?
I think he's right. Yeah, that one is very popular, and the disk image library that can support that, the types of disk images seems to be growing all the time.
Okay, and it's a floppy emulator.
Yeah, and it's a form factor of a floppy drive, and you can, as I recall, put an SD card in it. And
okay.
I've seen one up at the Seattle Club. They are extremely cool. But
I want to use floppies.
Yeah, you don't hear the chug, chug, chug. Not that I'm dissing that device, Barry, because I think that actually is a really good solution. But,
maybe those devices just have to play that sound the way the Virtual 2 software does on the Mac, where it plays the grinding of the disks of the Apple II.
Exactly.
You just put it in and it just grinds away. Or just run your Blender at the same time as you're reading data.
So let's go back even a little further. David, what began with Space War? What are you talking about here?
Oh, so there's a nice article over on The Verge, and it says, "It began with Space War, a history of science fiction in video games." So mostly I like the article. It talks about Space War and then moves into the Space War, the game on the PDP-1s, but then the going blank here, the Atari, stand-up arcade version. But it's just got some beautiful pictures in this article of like the terminal for the PDP-1, the little typewriter, you know, interface. And oh, and actually, this is an exhibit at the Museum of the Moving Image, which didn't that just we talked about that, or you guys did recently, or right? It's open recently.
It sounds familiar.
Oh, it opened on December 15th. It just opened on December 15th.
Yeah, so it's at the. It's currently going on at the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, New York, and I am going to go look at this thing because this looks like an incredible display.
But if you can't go, I mean, still look at this article and just look at these great, you know, high resolution close up shots of the equipment and stuff, and it's just it's really awesome, and especially the like the Atari Space War arcade. I mean, that thing is so wild looking. Are you guys looking at the picture?
And Computer Space, you know, the green one there.
That's what it is, Computer Space.
Yeah, thanks. Computer Space is the glittery, flaky green one. Like, just a gorgeous cabinet, which I think was featured, I think they may mention it here. Isn't that the one that's in Soylent Green?
It's people!
But they've got Space War and Defender, of course, and Space Invaders, and just sort of shows the cabinet. I'm going to collect all of these.
Yeah, I know. We got the bug now.
I'm going to have them all by next show.
Very cool.
There's something so different about, you know, walking into a room with a lot of cabinets and stuff and playing games. It really is a different experience. All of us experienced that, though, in the old days.
Throws it back to the 70s and 80s. Yeah, the Portland Retro Gaming Expo where they had the free play area with all the stand-up arcade games. It's just awesome.
Or sit-down ones. In this article, it's got the environmental cabinet for the old Star Wars vector game.
Oh,
holy cow, I loved that game.
Yeah. That was fun, wasn't it?
And another one I really enjoyed was the Star Trek sit-down one. Did you
ever
play that one?
Which I don't think is here. It doesn't look like that's featured here.
But, I didn't see in the pictures. But it was a similar – I assume they used that same basic sort of cabinet, if you will.
Sure, my two favorite environmental cab games have always been this Vector Star Wars and Discs of Tron. I loved Discs of Tron and the environmental cabinet.
I haven't clicked on this link yet. One question I have.
Defender, Space Invaders.
Are the pictures high res or are they just because one of the things that really kind of, makes me sad or annoys me or something is when they've got these articles and they've got
Little pictures.
They've got obviously beautiful pictures of beautiful equipment, but the pictures are small and you can't click on them to enlarge them.
These ones you can't enlarge, but they're nice big pictures to start with.
Yeah, and they're very clear and sharp and the color looks right and everything. So, yeah, anyway.
Good.
I wish I could go see it. I really do. I wish I could go to... I wonder if we'll ever start seeing retro arcades coming back up. I mean, maybe... I guess they do... in bigger, like New York City and places like that.
Well, we have a retro arcade here. We've got Ground Control in Portland.
Yeah, see,
it's very popular.
I know.
And meanwhile, if you're interested in that topic, tune in to No Quarter, the podcast about that.
I am interested.
Nice plug. Shameless plug there.
It's funny, though, for an exhibit, one last thing, is that some of the machines are kind of, pretty rough. Like the Star Wars is a little, it's not too bad, but it's definitely in very used condition.
Yep. Beaten up, you mean?
No, I mean...
Disney guys just showed up and did it on purpose. They seem to do that to
them. Yeah.
They did it to mine.
Well, so time sharing. This is old, like, Space War, right? I think it's actually, like, around the same time period when the time sharing systems really started to kick in the early to mid-60s, if I recall. So there's a good video on YouTube. Apparently... back in the day, there was a feature, might have been from WGBH in Boston, called the MIT Science Reporter. And one of the shows that they did, one of the episodes on here, was on the time-sharing system at MIT's computer lab. And it actually has footage, tutorial footage. It's interesting the way that it's presented by a gentleman named Corbato, who was one of the... pioneers, actually, of this time-sharing type of concept. And I love this video. I love the old... You can just tell the 60s dialogue You know, it has that kind of dragnet feel to it. And the video itself, where they go through how time sharing works and how it's going to save them money, and they look at some of the terminals back then that they were using, highly recommend this video.
It's a great video, and you should stick with it as well. The opening is interesting, especially because he calls himself, I'm the MIT science reporter. I'm like, that's a thing? And So the first part's interesting, but then the middle chunk is that classroom setting, where you have the little bow tie professor fellow sort of explain all this with a chalkboard, and it was great. Like, so if you're interested in this topic, it's a fantastic video to see. This was found, Earl. Good find.
I don't know how I stumbled on this. I was trying to remember how I found this video. But the interesting thing I found was, if you want to know how time sharing works, it's not that different today. I think somebody even made that comment on this YouTube video. It is more sophisticated today, but a lot of the concepts remain the same. So anyway, yeah, I really enjoyed that. That was fun. It is a longer video as these things go. I think it was 23, 24 minutes, something like that. Wow, who's messing with the show? Somebody's messing with the show, Doc.
I'm watching everything. That's David going crazy with 90-point type in our show,
exactly.
Doc. Exactly.
Go easy on the bold face.
I was going to type, settle down, David. Settle down.
Let's see, computer books, software, joystick, what should I get them? If you're trying to figure out what to get the hacker on your Christmas shopping list, Gary, Wendy Woods, Paul Schindler, George Morrow, and I'll be here in just a minute to give you our picks for Christmas presents from the computer store on this special Christmas edition of the Computer Chronicles. Welcome to the Computer Chronicles. I'm Stuart Chaffee, but it's either Gary Claus or Santa Kildall. I'm not sure which. Gary, this is the ultimate high-tech Christmas present for the hacker on your list. It's a Christmas card on a floppy disk. It's $9.95. It's called the Jingle Disk from ThoughtWare, and it just plays a whole series of animated Christmas cards and Christmas jingles, as you can tell. The only thing I don't know how to do is to stop this thing.
Well, let me use a little hardware adjustment here. My bit banger, I'll work on it a little bit. My frustration's out.
Is this hardware or software?
It's a hardware adjustment.
Gary, we're going to be talking about computer Christmas presents on this show. You have any things you're buying for
people? Well, this is sort of a Tinker Toy for Techies show, and I went out and did it as an excuse. I went out and bought myself a present.
Okay, well, you're going to show it to us in just a little bit.
The year's biggest retail event is Christmas. Normally, placid shoppers rush into crowded stores, and every kind of consumer product gets a boost in sales, including computers.
I think the computers are moving very well this year. The drop in prices in the expensive top-of-the-line machines has picked up sales in that area and taken away a little from the less expensive machines.
While the range of affordable machines has expanded, different features appeal to different kinds of customers. A youngster is more likely to want color graphics than a spreadsheet, so Christmas sales of low-end computers are brisk. But as the gap narrows between home and office machines, all shoppers are getting smarter.
People have gotten more knowledgeable, which is helpful. They do seem to know what they want. They have people, friends who own computers, have computers, use computers, so they're able to get better counsel from their friends.
Computer sales have been disappointing this year, and many stores have closed their doors for good. But retailers are optimistic that computers will continue to excite the public.
Well, we're expecting this to be the best part of the year. History will tell whether it was a great year or what. We're not deterred by the last year as far as things being in a slump. It should be good.
I'm going into the retro computing gift section, which is possibly, if you're trying to get somebody a Christmas gift, it's a little late. But this is still a fun gift, I think. You guys tell me, give me your impression. But a few months ago, I was thinking, should I refurbish my Epson acoustic coupler? I've got something called the CX20. It actually ran on batteries, was a 300 baud acoustic coupler that you could carry around with your Epson laptop. And I thought, why would I do that when I don't have a telephone that has the right shape of handset that I could plug into it? I could make it work, but there'd be no way to use it. And then I thought, I wonder if anybody makes those handsets. Lo and behold, there are. You can get, the old classic shape of handset that either hardwires into your cell phone, or there are a little bit more expensive ones that are Bluetooth. But I just thought, that's great. And boy, if I could find a 300 baud modem to call, I could actually BBS literally like it was back in the day. So I've got a link up here to Amazon that will be in the show notes for this Red handset. It was surprisingly inexpensive and got good reviews overall. And there are, and also, when you go to this link, you'll see that Amazon lists a whole range of these things at various prices and capabilities. I just thought that would be fun for a retro geek to actually be able to do the old acoustic coupler thing where you plug in.
Very cool. Did either of you guys ever run a BBS?
I did not. I was an avid BBS user. I was not a BBS sysop. Something that I regret to this day. You know,
I ran two of them. One early one that transitioned over to Apple II stuff, and then I ran one later on Macintosh that was first that graphical one that came out for the Macs early on. First Choice, something like that it was called, the software. I can't remember what it was called. It was called the Rabbit Hole. So I ran that one for a number of years. I still have friends today that I met who were members of that BBS. So that's how we met, is they were local to Toronto and way back then were members on my BBS, and then we met IRL, as they say, and we're friends still to this day.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how that BBS culture did result in a lot of friendships, and if you watch the BBS documentary, even marriages and all kinds of... I just interviewed Kevin Savitz, the author of Terrible Nerd, for... episode of RetroBits, and he was mentioning also just the computer that you had back in the day had an effect on your social circle and friends that
it still does.
All that, yeah, I guess it still does. Yeah,
and David's first class. It was bugging me.
That's the name of the BBS system that you ran.
Yeah, so I ran that one for years on first class. That was it. Yeah.
David added something fun here too. We might have talked about this before. This is. It's got to be in the pantheon of retro computing movies, you know, great retro computing movies, Pirates of Silicon Valley. Apparently, you can get the DVD for $4.99. Nice. And I found that you can rent it really cheaply if you just want to watch it one or two times. You can rent it inexpensively on YouTube. Did you guys know that you can rent videos on YouTube?
No.
You can. Wow. There are some commercial videos that you can rent on YouTube. You go searching for it, and there it is. It says, you know, rent for X number of dollars.
I knew there were commercial videos on YouTube. I just thought they were all pirates.
No. Apparently, YouTube is cashing in on this phenomenon that people go to YouTube looking for these videos, and they're saying, hey, you can't have it for free, pal.
Yeah,
But you can rent it cheaply.
Cool. The Pirates of the Silicon Valley is indeed already in our Retro Computing Gift Guide, which you can find at rcrpodcast.com/giftguide.
And
it links over to the
movie,
Amazon one, so it's $4 or $5.
Yeah, you got to see it. I mean, come on. So, other things you can buy. eBay auctions. Carrington, what's a toaster Mac?
What do you mean, what's a toaster Mac? It's the old original Mac shape. Like when you think of the iconic Macintosh, the little 9-inch gray screen or black and white screen. So the original Mac and then the 512KE, the fat Mac, which was my first Mac, the SE, the SE30, that sort of thing.
Call these a toaster Mac?
Well, because they kind of look like a toaster. Imagine the shape. Sort of you put there was the pizza box, which is the LC, the original LCs, LC2, 3, 475, those are the pizzas. And this was the toaster Macs. So that toaster Mac range has two screws that are hard to get at under the handle.
Yep.
So you imagine you're holding one. It's way down in there, and it's an odd shape as well. It's one of the first times I ever had to – I think it's a Torx. It's only like a T8 or something, so it's not a crazily obscure bit, although at the time it was. It was the first time I ever had to use a Torx. I think it was cracking open one of my first toaster Macs. But it's hard to get at because it's not only under the handle. It's like then recessed down these little holes. And so if you have a toaster Mac and you want to open it up for any reason, add RAM, swap the hard drive, whatever, the easiest way is to have one of these long tools. It's basically the correct Torx at the one end, and it's just a long bit. They were much more common back in the day, and I had one years and years ago, but I haven't had one in ages. And it turns out they're not that hard to come across. I had just sort of forgotten about it as a tool, so I wanted to bring it up and say, here's my choice, $4.50. You can grab yourself the easiest way to open up one of those original Toaster Macs. So that's my
choice. We used to call them Mac crackers.
Okay.
You pull them at
Christmas time and make a pop.
I had, you know, the certification for Mac repair back in those early Mac days, and we had tools that had the Torx on one side and then the long stem, because like you say, the screws were deeply recessed.
Right.
And on the other end was a little spring-loaded case cracker or case opener that you could stick in the seam there and gently open up the case so that you didn't wind up damaging the Macintosh.
Yeah, you need some sort of spudger to yank them open, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think when they were newer at the time, because I remember hearing that a lot more in the old days, the case cracking thing. I think when they were newer, it was much harder to open them. The plastic was newer or whatever.
That's right, yeah.
So it was harder to separate the cases.
Stiff. It's a pinata full of technology.
And you didn't want to break the pinata.
No. And of course, you can see them sometimes where people use a screwdriver and it's like bending the case and stuff, prying it open.
And you can see the marks left in the plastic from that as well.
Yeah, right.
Old Macs, you can see the ones that have been worked on, because often they've got these gouges in the side where the case has been yanked open.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, $4.50, probably the cheapest eBay auction item I have selected.
Very good pick.
Yeah.
What about you, David? What have you got?
All right, well, before I talk about it, though, I was wondering why I kept trying to say something when we were back on the Pirates of Silicon Valley thing. And I was like, why are you stepping all over me, Earl? But apparently I had to hit mute.
No, Earl and I both have a mute button for you.
I know. You're like, why are you guys not letting me talk? But just
quiet,
to mention
David.
About it,
be quiet.
The only reason I threw the Pirates of Silicon Valley in there is because I had heard James and John mention it on the Retro Maccast. And so it's $5, you know, shipped. It was such a good deal. But also, if you're Amazon Prime, so of course that would be free shipping. You can watch that for free if you have Amazon Prime.
Oh,
so that,
nice.
So not all their movies. A lot of them you can rent, but there's a lot of movies on Amazon that you can watch for free as well through Amazon Prime. So you know, it's another benefit for $80 a year. But then you get all your shipping, you know, 2-day free.
Cool. Better than Optimus Prime.
So this relates back to your acoustic coupler, Earl. So I found a really cool acoustic coupler modem, a very early example from the 60s from Livermore Data Systems. And from what I've heard and seen before, I believe this is one of the earliest examples of a modem. And I also will be in the show notes. I put a link to a YouTube video, which I believe we discussed before, of a guy using this exact same type of, he calls it a 1964 antique modem. Yeah, doing a demo with a modern computer.
This is a seriously gorgeous modem.
Isn't it great?
Holy cow, that case is lovely.
I know.
And now, is this a handmade thing? Like, did it come like this, or did somebody build this wooden
case? It came like this, and so the company made them this way.
It must have come like this, because that video that you referenced, David, it looked identical to this.
Yeah. Absolutely gorgeous. It looks like a steampunk thing. Like, it's just with the wood and the brass and...
So right now it's in New York. It's $49.99. It's got the opening bid. It's got 4 days to go. So I don't know. Who knows how much it'll go for? I'm tempted to try to buy it, though. It's just so cool.
Mm-hmm.
It is the prettiest modem I've ever seen. Like, really, that's a beautiful case.
Yeah, and if you want to have an acoustic coupler in your collection, man, this is the one to get.
That would be the one. And the price right now is really reasonable,
yeah.
I think.
So I think it's going to be pretty rare, so we got to sort of watch this one. But yeah, especially if you've not seen the video of, and I should have had it up to say what the guy's name is, but we'll link to it. Go look at the guy, you know, demonstrating.
Because then you can chat with that guy.
Yeah.
You guys can get together and go full duplex. I can't do what I'm typing. Awesome. Nice choice.
Yeah, cool.
So right. I have a couple of auction picks. The first one is a Sirius Commodore PET.
Wow.
We're talking about a rack-mounted, rehosted PET with a little built-in screen. I've never seen anything like this. I don't know if these were commercially
rack-mounted PET.
Yeah, well, so...
Someone early on, right? They wanted to...
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things, the PET had a IEEE 488 interface, which made it at least electrically compatible with a lot of test equipment. I don't actually know how much it was really used for that purpose. But if I recall correctly, it's one of the things that Chuck Peddle had said was a design, an intentional design criteria was to give it that IEEE interface. And so maybe this was used for that. I don't know.
I wish that was pronounced
You can say it that way if you want.
Now, I noticed a key word in the description here. It says keyboard is contained in a slide-out Tempest enclosure. Isn't that a government thing?
Yeah, the Tempest was a way to reduce emitted RF and other signals that could be used by the evil commies to
Back to our earlier thing about the ZX Spectrum.
Yes.
So, but
so it must have been a government thing, maybe.
So I don't know. I don't know if this was a commercially manufactured product or if this is a one-off. Or
it's a cool-looking keyboard.
I think it controlled our battleships in the 1970s.
I like the keyboard. Too bad it's not the chiclet one, just to punish you. Nice.
And the other thing that I picked, because I didn't want to have two picks and, you know, go all prima donna here.
But you did.
But I did because I saw this at the last minute, and how could I resist?
What is that?
It is like that other thing that we had.
It looks like a tape dispenser.
It isn't, though. It's another manual card punch. You use this little dial on the left to pick the character that you want to punch, and then you hit the punch button, and it punches out your punch card. And it's circa 1966 from this Univac mainframe center.
Oh, cool. And then you roll it like another – and then – oh, nice. Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this you know, it seems like I've seen this seller selling some other artifacts that found in this.
Yeah, click on the guy's other stuff. He's got tons of other stuff.
Yep. Some very interesting stuff, too, by the way. But I just I love punch cards and this idea of a manual card puncher. Now, he does say that this one is going to need some work because apparently the card gets jammed or something like that going through there. What do you want? I mean, the thing's almost 50 years old, but just looked really cool.
I think the temperature's dropping out here.
Good.
Yeah.
It's getting chilly.
Getting a little wind chill? Well, well, hey, with that, why don't we move into the closing discussions then?
Okay.
Carrington, you were going to talk about why you're so pretty and why occasionally you enjoy a good game of strip Pictionary.
Oh, yeah, baby. Here we go. What's new with me? This big beast behind me is like the big news in Carrington Land. So
that is great. What a great Christmas present to yourself.
To me, from me, with love.
I mean, seriously, that is so great.
So I'm really excited about it. So just looking at that and then waiting for the next game. And so I guess I'm now suddenly collecting arcade cabinets. That's sort of news. So I blame Mike McGinnis doing this this weekly show about these things with him doing that the No Quarter at monsterfeed.com.
And I think I'm sure he hates you now too once he sees that.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Well, he'll hate me once I start only buying the games he likes the most.
Yeah, right.
And I got one other cool thing, which we'll bring in now for show and tell. This Blue Box, which I know doesn't make for great radio, but for those listening, so what it is a Royal typewriter. I've always had one typewriter, so I like to occasionally, when I give away the software for one makers, that kind of stuff, I always type up the label on my little typewriter because it comes all nice and retro.
Fine.
And my typewriter finally died. I repaired it a few times, so finally gave up the ghost. And I was looking for, well, what am I going to replace it with? I've had the last typewriter for like 15 years. So I looked around, and I finally decided on this one. So it comes in this little blue box here. But what's interesting about it, let me open it up.
That's like a student model, isn't it?
Well, it's just a portable manual typewriter. It's called the Royal Swinger. And I love the lines of it. I love the blue look. It's got a 60s sort of feel to it. It's got really nice action on the keyboard. I like a typewriter that has the switch between high and low so you can adjust the sensitivity of how hard you have to type because my wimpy computer fingers can no longer press on a manual typewriter the way they used to. And I just really like the look of it. But what I like particularly about the Swinger line by Royal, and it was the same feature that was in the, I think it's called the Fairmount or the Fairline, something like that, which was the same computer done a little later with a fake wood paneling top. So this is all the blue and red. is the case itself has a neat feature. So it's a portable computer, a little handle, you can cut around, built into the case.
Typewriter, I think you meant.
Is an AM radio.
Wow!
So it's tunable, and so you can take it to a cottage or beach or whatever. You got your AM radio built in and the typewriter.
I just
loved it as a feature, and it's hard to find one with the radio still working like fully. And so I've been looking around for a few months to try to find one of these things that wasn't, you know, $500. And then finally one came up cheap, and so I snagged it. So I've been really, really happy with it. So it's my new gadget, my radio typewriter. Love it.
Very nice.
Yeah, totally awesome little piece of kit.
It actually looks a lot like the Smith Corona student model that I had when I was growing up.
What do you think? It's 1970s then, probably, you think, with the radio? Or mid-60s?
Yeah, these were made late 60s. I think this was after the last line of Royals that was still made in North America. So this would have been made in Japan. Mm-hmm. And I think these were made between 68 and mid-70s or something like that. So the Fairline version or whatever is the one that looks much more 70s
that's when radios were really getting to be.
Yeah.
And that's when radios were getting to be, you know, about the size they could stick it in the case.
Yeah, they
could
actually stick it into the case. And so it fits into that place that's sort of – it's in this bit here above the keyboard in the case. There's that space for it. So
yeah, it's really nice.
It's really nice action on it. It's got a reversible ribbon. It's one of the later Royals, so the ribbons are still really easy to find, and it's easy to re-ink these ribbons if you want. Mm. So I always try to get a typewriter where the problem is them. If you can get one with working keys, they'll last for ages, provided you can get ribbons for them. The ribbon is always the hard thing. So these are easy to find ribbons. It was just hard to find this particular model in this color scheme, which is the one I wanted, this lovely blue. So, yeah, so that's my newest gadget.
So what's going on with you, David? And also, I was just curious if there's any other YouTube comments.
Yeah, I was just
y'all
there.
Y'all say down with David, David must go. You know, the usual stuff.
GameBit said he ran a BBS. And then Eric Nielsen, I guess, said I had a board back in the mid-late 80s, the Rat's Cage. And then I asked...
Does he say what he ran it on, or was it probably an Apple II thing, I guess?
No other comments, really. I had asked GameBits what was the BBS called, and he hasn't answered yet. The Playground.
It says laggy YouTube comments.
The Playground, he just answered.
Oh, cool.
So the only news or anything new is... I'm enjoying time off now, you know, from my job. So over the holidays, I'm off through the day after Christmas. I only have to work 2 days and then be off, a 4-day weekend after that for the New Year's.
Awesome.
But some stuff has been going on about the Vintage Computer Festival Southeast 1. And it was sort of the main big sponsor of it is Lonnie Mims, who is a huge collector in the Atlanta area. And, so he's obviously one of the big, he's going to be one of the big exhibitors, too. He's going to be doing an Apple exhibit. And so he asked that we need to push it back a little bit. And anyway, we finalized the dates now. It was to be 1 day, so now it's actually going to be 2 days. So it's all set now. It's going to be Saturday and Sunday, April 20th and 21st. So that's a good 2.5 months later than originally scheduled. And it is a little tight on the Vintage Computer Festival East in New Jersey, which is just about 1 month later.
But you wouldn't get the same people going at the two events, though, right?
No. So in one sense, I felt kind of like, oh, that's kind of tight on them. But, yeah, how many
I'll
people?
I'll go to East. You go to that one. We'll get those beautiful wooden acoustic coupler modems. Top, we'll do a little chat.
It'll take about a month for my signal to get over to you.
That's perfect. I don't listen anyway.
But, I don't see it being that big of it. I mean, really, how many people is going to come down to it where they go, which one am I going to go to? Possibly a couple people. But anyway, so now it's going to be 2 days, and that, I think that's exciting, and I think we feel like it makes more sense to have it over 2 days to give the best option for people to come, especially anybody who might come from out of town, to be more worthwhile their trip. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be 9:30, both start on 9:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. on the Saturday till 5 on the Sunday. So it's going to be a pretty, full-on sort of thing now.
Nice.
It's a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
So you can go to vintage.org, and the main page needs to be updated, but the other date's been changed. I'm going to start filling in information now about places to stay and work out the exhibits. And, I guess I'll go ahead and announce this. I think it's pretty official. It's not 100%. Things can happen, but... the keynote speaker is going to be, and of course now I'm about to announce it, and I'm going blank in my head. Robert Timmy. And do you guys know who that is? He's the artist that did all the covers of Byte magazine.
Oh, cool.
Ooh, very
so,
nice.
So Lonnie Mims, the big collector here, he actually has a bunch of originals of the man's paintings, which that's pretty crazy. They're really nice. Mm. And so he's going to come and be one – I think he might be one of two keynote speakers. And anyway, that should be good. I think his talk would be pretty interesting because, you know, he was right there doing a lot of the covers for Byte for a number of years.
The early Byte covers were awesome.
Yeah, and really neat pieces of art. And I have a few prints of his, and I'm hoping maybe he'll sign them. I hope that'd be appropriate. I don't know. Do artists do that? if you
I
show up with
so.
Your print of an artist, will they sign it for you? I don't know.
Sure.
Or, I can't to ask. So that's the big my big news.
Well, it'll be exciting to hear updates on that as you go along.
And it gives you two more time, and you know, to maybe try to make it.
Try and save up for airfare?
No, I'm going to go to the one in the east. Screw you.
Treat yourself. Go to both.
So, well, on my side, actually, I think I alluded to it. I've got a RetroBits episode that's actually ready to publish, but my audio software is crashing. I tried to record the intro and get everything all set up, and I have to debug my audio software. So that actually would have been out there already, but probably in a day or two.
Why don't you just, instead of doing the intro, just have post your telephone number, and anybody who wants to hear it, they just call you.
They can
and
just
you
call
just
for
live.
The intro. Sure,
come on,
sure.
A little customer service. God,
that'd be good.
Geez, don't be so lazy. In fact, I'll handle that for you. Let me just post your private telephone number online right now. There we go. The call should start rolling in.
1-888-RetroBits. So,
you say that. Now people are going to call it. And
Gagne
I wonder
and
what
McGinnis
that number is.
Upstaged me and had...
Gagne and McGinnis.
Kevin Savitz on their show, but of course my interview will be better than them. So, what else is going
that
on?
Game best.
M4th. I've been playing with a fourth interpreter on the TRS-80 Model 100.
What happened to the first three?
I don't know. Something they, I deleted them. So again, this doesn't make for good radio, but my Model 100, and I've got a little doodad in here called a Rex, which is a flash ROM for the Model 100. Very cool. You can have a whole bunch of different ROMs on your Model 100 and choose between them.
I love the Model 100.
Oh, it's such a cool
The 100,
computer.
And what was the other one? The 102.
The 102, yeah. That. And there was a rarer one, the 200. But
it's such it's got a really, for such a small device, it has a great keyboard. Like, just such a good keyboard on this.
Well, and a beautiful display, too.
Yep.
When I look at this compared to my Epson PX8, which has more characters, more real estate, but the display on the Model 100 just beats it all to heck. It's,
yeah, it's
so
very visible in lots of different conditions and everything. Yeah, I love the Model 100. And they're built like a – you feel like you could, beat off attackers with them.
Yes. Well built, too. Thing. And that probably one of the reasons why it was so popular with journalists. But Forth is an interesting language, and I like poking around with it. So I saw that came out, and I had to play with it. And what else did I want to – oh, Retro Challenge. Let's not forget RetroChallenge.net. So if you guys are going to do something, now's the time to send in your entry. And I'm going to do something on the Commodore. I'm probably going to post that I'm going to finish that Reversi game that I started a while back that
Excellent.
I just kind of left hanging.
Yes, you left us hanging on that one. Like,
yeah.
We had half a show about it, sort of.
Yeah, that's right.
Show, but only,
it's
nice.
Like, I didn't go any further with that, but I am going to go further now.
Good choice.
Did you see there's a prize this time? So,
there's
by the way,
a nice prize, a Cambridge Z88.
Yeah, so it's for the entire month of January, starting January 1st. So it's, Cambridge Z88, along with a copy of the October 1976 Byte magazine that I guess is it talking about that issue? I mean, about that computer?
No, that would have been too early. Z88.
Is there a connection to the... Yeah, so there's a prize. I don't know. I should think up something.
There's a prize? That's crazy.
Yeah, I know. Usually they
just do it for the fun of doing it.
They have terrible prizes, but they have a good prize.
We need to do another contest, don't we? We got to do something.
Oh, for the RCR.
So can you guys explain to me with the Retro Challenge? So this is it that you have to do it in the month of January or that you sign up in the month of January?
No, you have to sign up now. You do it in the month of January. It runs, and it's the winter warm-up.
Oh, easy.
There's two events per year. There's the classic event in the summer, and in the winter, you've got this warm-up event. And You know, you can kind of get started before. Some people are posting what I guess I'd call prequel blogs, how they're prepping to get ready for the Retro Challenge, but you really do the bulk of the stuff in January.
And it's funny just how they retro. Consider anything 10 years old or older to be qualified. And yeah, like, to me, that doesn't seem that old.
As David pointed out, I think in the last show, their rules have actually dialed in a little bit, but it's still pretty loose. It's
I think the rule should be it should cause sufficient radio interference to shut down everything else in your house. That means it's real retro.
Then I win.
If you fire it up, the neighbor should no longer get cable.
That's right. That's right. Comcast hates me, but the electric company loves me.
They're not happy until you're not happy.
Well, I guess that's issue of Bytes, $25 value on eBay right now.
Yeah.
Two copies. So.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's a decent price.
The Cambridge Z88, those go for not that I'm, you know, what it's valued at is everything, but.
No, it's just, it's a fun prize.
Yeah, it's nice.
The fact that it's a prize at all is pretty impressive, because yes. As far as I know, these never have prizes for these, don't they?
They've had little prizes, and you get the envy of all your fellow retro geeks, and yeah. So, all right, I'm wrapping it up. And hey, guys, we made it in well under an hour. I'm feeling
well done, Earl. You
really
win the internet.
Good about this, as all of us. There's no I in team.
But there's an M and an E, and that spells me!
Hey, Earl, can I say something before you wrap it up?
One last thing.
Here we go.
We'll still get out of here. So
sure. Last show, I listened as a listener, audience last show, and I realized something. Okay, we're winding down, and there was like 35 minutes later.
some comments, some of our watchers' comments.
Tell it.
So GameBits, he said his BBS, I already said this, was the Playground. It was an Apple II Warp 6 BBS.
Oh, okay, cool.
Eric Nielsen did his on the C64.
Awesome.
GameBits said, what audio software do you use, Earl?
I use kind of an obscure package called Magix Samplitude Music Studio. So it's just off the wall, but I really love the way that it works. It's just that I upgraded to Windows 98. I didn't reinstall the software. I'm probably just going to have to rip it out and reinstall it to get it to work.
And then one last question.
Newfangled Windows 98.
And then Carrington, Eric wants to know, any news on 8-bit archaeology? Our podcast,
yes.
Relay.
Both launch in January. So the first, 8-Bit Archaeology is sort of a combination. The 8-Bit Archaeology is a video show. It'll be my first video-type podcast thing. It's the thing that has held up 1 megahertz and so many other things, so they could launch in sync. Launch is second week of January. I've recorded the first show already, and really the next two, the chunk of them. It's sort of a combination of unboxing old, still shrink-wrapped stuff from the 80s, and then reviewing the actual software. So it's sort of like the video component that will match up to a corresponding 1 megahertz show where I talk about more of the history and review and that kind of stuff. And then Podcaster Relay is, frankly, a rip-off of an idea on a BBC show that I really like that's done with celebrities. And it's a podcasting show where the first episode, I'm interviewing another podcaster about their gear, about why they got into it, the history, what they're doing, that kind of stuff. The next show, that person interviews another podcaster, and so they get to pick somebody.
Oh, okay.
So it's a show about podcasting. So people that are interested in podcasts, each person gets to be an interviewee and an interviewer. We talk about the gear, we talk about their personal history in podcasting, the shows they like, what their goals are, that kind of stuff. Short show, it'll be audio only, and that launches last week of January or first week of February, depending on the second guest choice. We're trying to get a few lined up ahead of time. So, yeah. Okay. The guests are surprised.
Oops, you're doing the Cylon thing on us a little bit again.
Stop it!
But you're back.
We heard it, but
well, I appreciate the folks watching live and with the comments. And you know, if you are listening to us on audio, which is the vast majority of folks who tune into the RCR, don't hesitate if you're bored and you know want to see our ugly faces. Go on over to YouTube/RCR podcast, and you can actually see us making a fool out of ourselves instead of just hearing us. And that's a wrap for this show. Guys, thank you very much. As always, what a pleasure. Our next show is January 6th. Am I reading that right? 6th?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So join us live for the recording. you can go to rcrpodcast.com for the links and the show notes. You can check out our forum, the podcasting forum, over at vintage-computer.com. Please help us spread the word in other forums, at your local coffee shop, with your friends, various places on the interwebs, and through tweets. Review us on iTunes if you like us, and if you don't, then let us know why you don't. What are we doing wrong?
Then only review David on iTunes.
That's right. Follow us on Twitter at RCR Podcast, at Carrington, at Classic Computin, and at Retro.
All us all.
And feedback to the show can be sent to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And as always, Retro Compute.
Retro Compute. Bye, guys.
See you guys.
Happy holidays.